You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 9th, 2001. Excuse me, 2014. Oh. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Barbara Meldaloni, the new president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association and a fierce opponent of neoliberal education reform. Also on the program today, more revelations about NSA spying. We now have names. Also on the program today, Chris McDaniel still not conceding, and Sarah Palin sends a shot across the bow of John Bonner. Is it just an attempt to get on The View? We'll find out. I'll get to that Kansas story as well. And meanwhile, in Israel and Palestine, escalation of violence. 35 Palestinians killed, many of them children, as Israel prepares to ramp up its incursion into the Gaza Strip. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, I'm having a little problem with my headphone. A reminder, folks, this program relies exclusively on members' support. By supporting this program, you allow us to continue our daily free show, and as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes of content a day. In Iraq, ISIS has taken control of a vast former chemical weapons facility northwest of Baghdad. And here's the point where you should read just a little bit deeper so that those neocon morons don't have a field day. Well, I thought there was no chemical weapons there, where remnants of 2,500 degraded chemical rockets filled decades ago with the deadly nerve agent sarin are stored along with other chemical warfare agents. It takes about, 100 tons of sarin, or a ton of sarin to kill 100 people on a battlefield.
Something like that. It was one of those places that Hans Blix went to and said, there's no active chemical weapons program here.
Yes, and this is also not a weapon of mass destruction. It is a rather inefficient way.
It's an inefficient
to kill people unless
weapon.
They're on a battlefield.
Right. And even then, not the most efficient.
So that needed to be said. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Barbara Meldaloni.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Barbara Maldaloni, she is the president of the Mass Teachers Association. Welcome to the program, Barbara.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me, Sam.
So let's start. My experience has been that there are some more localized teachers unions that have been on the forefront of fighting the corporate reform agenda and of schools. And I wanted to just start with your election. Can you contextualize this for us and let us express to us sort of the difference in tact that you represent in terms of the previous, I guess, teachers union regime in Massachusetts?
Well, I think the first thing that's really important to understand is what is the nature of what's happening to our public schools and what's been going on for the past really 30 years, but has really just heated up into overdrive in the last 10 years and gotten much worse under the Obama administration. And that is that public education has undergone a profound transformation in terms of how we think about its purpose, how we organize it, who has voice in it, and the actual practices that happen in the classroom, so that we have testing that, as they called it, the NEA convention this past week, a toxic testing environment, teacher evaluations that are connected to testing, standardization, charter schools, lack of autonomy. It's not the school that we went to. It's really a very different technocratic, dehumanizing space. And I ran for union president under the banner of Educators for a Democratic Union, which is a progressive caucus within the MTA, with the idea that we really needed to organize as union members and then grow alliances from the union out to parents and students to stop this ugly transformation, this dehumanizing transformation, and reclaim public schools for democracy, which is, you know, if we don't even use that word anymore to talk about public education, we don't talk, and then we don't explore that word. What does it mean to have a democracy? What does it mean to raise young people to enter a democracy? So I came to understand in my own practice and in my work, both as an English teacher and as a teacher educator, that teachers were feeling as small and dehumanized and silenced by these what I call deforms instead of reforms. And we need to organize, remember that history teaches us that solidarity and working together is our strength as a people in a democracy, and I wanted to be a part of that. What I discovered in my campaign is that teachers wanted to be a part of that, educators wanted to be a part of that, that they didn't want any more to sort of know themselves as needing to adjust to this assault, but they wanted to know themselves as people who could fight back. The union leadership that we'd been under had sort of their approach to the assault was, let's accommodate, let's have it not be as bad as it could be, let's see how we can tweak these reforms to make them less harmful. And what that was creating in educators across Massachusetts, and I think it's happening across the country, is a sense of themselves as powerless and helpless and hopeless. Nobody wants to live in that space. And so what my campaign offered was a sense of hope and solidarity and strength if we reclaim not only a vision for public education, but a vision for what a union can be.
I mean, that's incredibly encouraging, particularly in light of conversations that I've had with some of my daughter's teachers over the years. And some of them expressed to me that there was a generational divide in that some of the younger teachers, and I imagine this is, too broad of a generalization, and I think to a certain extent your ascent in Massachusetts may run counter to this generalization, but that younger teachers
didn't necessarily have a sense of how things were. And so they don't have that vision of how they can be. Did you find any of that?
Yeah. I think nothing is sort of that black and white, simple lines to draw. My experience as a teacher educator was that people still become teachers for very idealistic reasons. I mean, it's hard work. It entails incredible commitment of your time and your intellectual, emotional, physical life. So people are driven into teaching, or compelled to become teachers, for, you know, based on values and beliefs that I think lots of us would share about, you know, giving young people voice and bringing them enthusiastically into literature or mathematics or the sciences. And yet at the same time, young teachers didn't have a lot of experience about how to actually do that. They maybe for themselves in their own education experience found some space that was positive and joyful, but they would be surprised about them, you know, how do we do that with a range of students and students who are coming from different life contexts when they're coming. So it's sort of both that people want, young people want something more, young teachers, and yet didn't have experience to know how to do that. But one of the things that was really interesting about my campaign is how many younger teachers became involved with the union through my campaign. We had 500 first-time delegates to the annual meeting where I was voted in. Those were people who, many of them, who had been teaching for 2, 3, 5, 6 years, so they were relatively new teachers who had not seen the union as a place where they could answer questions about how do I live the things that brought me into teaching. So what's exciting is that not only are they imagining that they can do something else, but that they're understanding that the union is a place that they can find the solidarity to fight for and do that work.
So let's talk about more about the so-called reform movement. And you know, one of the things that has struck me over the years in talking about this is that the best slogans all seem to come from that reform movement. I mean, and just the sort of the top line of the initiatives. I mean, for instance, the other day, I think it was Arne Duncan and the Obama administration were talking about they want to develop an initiative to get better teachers in poorer schools. And much of this is coming in the wake of the Villagara ruling in California. And we can talk about that specifically. But talk about why this notion of simply saying, I mean, it sounds great. Of course, we want to get better teachers in poorer schools. But that really belies what the real problems are, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And, you know, you're spot on in terms of how much they've really been able to control the narrative about schools. And it's fascinating to me that they've been so successful in creating sort of the idea of the bad teacher, right? There's this monster out there, and it's the bad teacher, and we have to figure out how to take down the bad teacher. When, in fact, if you talk to people and you ask them, how do you feel about your children's teachers? Like, overwhelmingly, people feel good about teachers. So they've even been able to create a narrative that is counter to people's actual experiences. That's like really good marketing. I've got to, you know, hand it to them about that. So if we go back to this idea that just came out of the from Duncan about, you know, we need quality teachers in these poor schools, it is loaded with misinformation. The most important piece of information about the misinformation is that the problems with our schools in poor neighborhoods is that those kids are poor.
Right.
It's about economic injustice. It's about kids who go to school having not slept in the same bed for 3 weeks in a row because they're homeless. It's because their parents are working 3 jobs and they go home to empty houses, and their parents are just barely making it with those three jobs that they're working. That's the story that our Department of Education refuses to tell. And if we as a country put the same amount of energy and talk and resources into really addressing poverty, then we would be able to make some meaningful change for our students in our schools.
I mean, I think that, you know, that to me seems to be the sort of the biggest crux. I mean, in every educator I have spoken to have talked about poverty being the premier determinant factor of the ability of a child to learn in this context. And it also, the flip side of that is that it seems to me that much of what we talk about in education, so-called education reform, is a way to put a fig leaf over that fundamental problem.
Yeah, I think it's worse than a fig leaf. I mean, I think it's a profound distraction from really what's going on in this country, which is that we have the greatest economic injustice that we've had in a century. And we're blaming teachers who go in every day to try to help young people make sense of lives that offer them no future. But those teachers go in every day and try to form relationships and introduce young people to the world in a way that allows some possibility of hope. And those are the people that we're blaming for the economic injustice in this country. I think it's very deliberate that's happening. And the thing that's important to understand about that is that narrative is being driven by the 1%, by the Koch brothers, by the Broad Foundation, by the Walton family, by Bill Gates, who are the ones who are really controlling the narrative about education, about its purpose and its possibilities, and who we are supposedly to blame for what isn't working in public education. I mean, they don't even want public education. They don't even talk about it that way anymore because their goal is to undo public education, to privatize it, to profit from it, and to bust teachers' unions who are going to be critical in protecting this absolutely essential space if we want to continue our democratic project.
Give me a sense of your perception of, and it's always hard to get into sort of the motives of any specific individuals, but in my conversations in the past, I think the motives of the privatization movement and the sort of what I call the corporate reform movement is both a function of the desire to privatize because of ideological reasons, the desire to profit, and also I think Bill Gates is a perfect example, it seems to me, of taking principles from his business world and assuming, because he's been so successful in that those can be applied to education. Talk to us about why those principles of bottom line, number-driven, data-driven accountability just simply don't translate in the world of education.
I actually don't think they translate any space. and I don't say that lightly. I think it's important to go back to understand where those principles are. As you noted, it's an ideology. And it's an ideology that says that what it means to be human is to relate to other human beings within the context of the market. That it is about products, it's about consumptions. We are either producers or consumers. That's how we know each other. Therefore, if that is the case, if we are individuals in competition with each other in this market, then it makes sense for us to be counting and looking at output and looking at issues like efficiency, because we are then machines, human beings as machines, working to, as we hear from Obama and Duncan and others all the time, grow and compete within the global economy. There's a philosophical point of view there that says that's what it means to be human. I don't think that's what it means to be human. I don't think most of us, if we were given an opportunity to talk about it, would say that's what we want life to be. That's what we think is valuable in life. So these measures that they're using absolutely don't work in education, which is the space where we grow our future, right? We bring young people into the world and help them imagine how the kinds of communities that they're going to create. I don't want them. I don't think most of us want to bring young people into a world that's about numbers and efficiency and speeding things up and lean production and competition. But that's where they've brought us, because that's how they see the world. So we have to go back and say, what kind of world do we want to create? That's the core question. When I was a teacher educator, I always ask my students, you know, what is the world that you want to create? And then how do our schools help us create that world? So if we want a world that's diverse and complicated and equitable and democratic, what would our schools look like?
I mean, it's interesting because in the past several weeks, we've been talking about this broader neoliberal project. And in some ways, it seems like our education system is the final frontier for this neoliberalism. And this is where the battle line is being drawn. Is that your sense, that this is sort of the coup de grace in some respect?
I absolutely think so. I mean, I was actually a psychotherapist before I became an educator, and I, you know, was working in psychiatric hospitals back in the 80s and 90s and saw them undo the medical profession through this neoliberal ideology, and now we're left with, you know, holding onto straws with the Affordable Care Act and having abandoned, you know, a national healthcare system. So, yeah, we're it. We are the last place that they have yet to tackle. And part of why that's an important story to tell is that they've been successful, and they've been successful for decades around this, in pitting public sector unionized workers against private sector workers who are not unionized. That's very much the narrative. And the narrative is, to private sector workers, your life is terrible, and look how good those people have it. So let's make those people have a really bad life, too. And unfortunately, our union leadership under a business unionism model has not addressed that and said, no, we want to fight not just for our union members, but for the larger social justice project, right? So our unions have sort of bought in to allowing that division to grow. We now in education have an obligation to not only defend public education, to not only defend public education workers as union members, but to grow a movement through our defense of public education and our unions for social justice, for economic justice, for racial justice, for everybody. That's how much, this is the last stand, because if they beat us, it's all over. But it's also the last stand if we look forward to say, actually, this is a place from which we can grow a critical, necessary social justice movement. And I think educators are ready to do that.
Is it your sense, and obviously you've spent a lot of time in terms of in thinking about these different models of unionism, is it your sense that this is, and it just strikes me because I think of the Chicago's teachers union, and in conversations I've had with folks from that union and about that union, there seems to have been a similar model, or at least, you know, and I don't know, and maybe you can tell us more about how the your caucus that brought you to the election of being president of the Mass Teachers Association, how from a sort of a strategic standpoint you did that. And I wonder how much of this perception of teachers being on the forefront and being on this battle line sort of plays into that, or is that something that it is almost a I don't know, some type of spiraling feedback loop? In other words, are there some members of your union that perceive this struggle in that way? Is it something that it reverberates back to you, and then it reverberates back into the union, and it continues to grow this level of consciousness? And I don't mean to ask so many questions at one time, but also how much do you go into the community? How much of because it seems to me from my understanding that with the Chicago teachers, the relationships with the community and the adoption of those broader sort of issues, seeing their struggle in the context of these broader issues was really crucial into the sort of the reformation of that union.
Yeah, really good question. So I'm going to try to see if I can get through here. We are in a different place in terms of our growth, both as a caucus and then also now with my election as a union, than Chicago was, say, when the core caucus was, you know, first took leadership. I think we're much more in a place that's the spiraling that you talk about. When I went out in my campaign, and the initial sort of bottom line goal of the campaign, besides winning, was really to go out and talk to members and grow the caucus and help people grow an analysis, both of what was happening to them, what they were experiencing in their workspaces, and what we might do to combat that and to make change. That was the goal. What I discovered in the campaign was that educators were much more ready to embrace an analysis of the corporate assault as what was happening to them, and this being part of a neoliberal project, than I had anticipated them being. I thought that the campaign was going to require more education around that. So there were more people who were more ready to think that way and be part of the caucus and part of the campaign before that. There are also people who were still just responding to, oh my God, I can't do what I came to do as a teacher. And here I'm being offered a way to think about that. That's helpful. I don't know if I think about it yet. You know, so there are different people at different levels in terms of their understanding. And so our work as a union in the next 2 years for what will hopefully be my first term, and then there'll be a second term, is to bring that, both the analysis of what's happening and the ideas of how we can make change and be a stronger union to the membership. And that means going out and talking to parents. Now, Chicago has, I think, 90,000 members. Hmm. But they're in a city, right? And so there's a density to their ability to organize. We're spread out over the state. We have 110,000 members. We have people in very poor urban districts that are under profound assault. We have people in rural districts who are less in touch with the people in their region even about what's happening. And we have people in very wealthy districts. Who even there are beginning to feel this assault. So, you know, part of our job is to get all those members talking to each other and developing their understanding together of what's happening to us, and then develop an understanding together of what do we want to do about it. So we're at a different place than Chicago, but certainly Chicago is the place that I look to for ideas and information, and there are teachers across the country. It's not just Chicago where this work is happening, and people are talking to each other and helping each other within each of our contexts figure out what our next steps are.
I don't want to project too much of my narrative on this. So forgive me if the metaphor doesn't hold. But it's interesting to me, and again, maybe I'm just imposing something on here, but that just you are from the western part of the state. Northampton's about as far from the state house as you can get in Massachusetts, literally. And I wonder if the distance, the literal distance is also sort of a metaphorical one, and how important that is when it's projected on the failures or the successes of the national teachers' unions relative to their closeness, both metaphorical and literal, I guess, to what's happening in Washington.
Well, I think if we just look at Massachusetts, I don't know how much it's a physical distance as it is sort of a lived distance. It's about where you see the power line. And maybe the physical distance from the state house helped me to understand and helps people to understand where the power actually lies and that it's not in the state house. But my victory didn't just come from Western Massachusetts.
Right.
It came from across the state. And that's important for people to understand. You know, so the way I see it is it's about sort of what direction do you look for to understand where the power is. Do you think the power is in changing the Massachusetts state legislatures? Do you think the power is in Congress? Do you think the power is in getting Arne Duncan to resign, which is a great call, but who knows who would be put in after Arne Duncan? Or do you think that the power is in the people? Do you think that the power is in organizing and mobilizing members and parents and students to reclaim public education? At the core, that's what social justice unionism is about. That's what my campaign was about, which is we have the power. And it's the power of us talking to each other and organizing together with each other to make our demands known and then to create new possibilities. That's how I understand that difference. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, I think so. I mean, so tactically speaking, what becomes when you begin to sort of you organize towards a set of demands? What are those first demands? I mean, in pushing back on the millions upon millions of dollars that are involved in pushing things like, Common Core and in the way that it's implemented, the sort of an iPad or a tablet in every schoolhouse, or the notion of high stakes testing. What becomes, from a tactical standpoint, what becomes the first? What are the first set of demands? I mean, what's the best way to begin to pull at this ball of yarn, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two levels of answers to that question. I think broadly, the high stakes testing is absolutely a place that tactically it makes sense to go. I think it's a place that is easy for people to understand, teachers and parents and students, how destructive it is. There's a narrative there that's pretty direct about who's profiting from that and about the damage that it's doing to our children and to our teachers and our schools, and about the fact that it's even on the terms of the people who are imposing it on us, it is entirely and completely ineffective. So it has a lot of good points for it, and it's something that's been imposed nationally so we can organize both locally and nationally to resist that. So the United Opt Out movement is a really important piece of that. Here in Massachusetts, we passed at our annual meeting a new business item to call for a three-year moratorium on the PARC testing, which is the testing connected to the Common Core. So I think that it is both, it tactically works. I think we can have some victories from it, like the victory that they had in Seattle when the teachers refused to give the MAP tests. And we can also use it as a way to educate people about the broader picture while we're building alliances. So absolutely high-stakes testing first base. I think then other more local struggles also can be taking place, depending on where you are. You know, in New York City, in Chicago, in Boston, the issue of charter schools is absolutely critical. That's how they are undoing public education in these high-poverty urban districts with black and brown children. So the charter school struggle becomes really important there. In other districts, issues like the Common Core are going to surface as parents understand what's happening and are resistant to that and are willing to work with teachers to fight that. So I think we need to both sort of have a broader national strategy, but also see within the context of particular localities what the best struggle is, and then weave together connections across those locals, because it can't be top down. It has to be bottom up. So it has to come from what are the struggles that are relevant to the educators, the parents, and the teachers in the communities.
And then expand those out as people
yeah.
get involved.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have too much time left, but talk to me just a little bit about how race is leveraged, because when we talk about charter schools and Bobby Jindal and Scott Walker, governors of Louisiana and Wisconsin, had a piece, I'm not sure exactly where, an op-ed, maybe it was in the Washington Post, about the notion of school vouchers and whatnot. And even when Arne Duncan was talking about the rollout of Common Core and was saying, oh, well, now we have, suburban moms are suddenly upset because they're not their kids aren't doing well. There seems to be implicit and in some instances explicit. The Jacobin interview that that came to my attention and made me want to book you was Standing Up to Superman, a reference to the film that sort of glorified charters and Eva Moskowitz's Success Academies.
Mm-hmm.
The use of race seems to be the entry point, sort of the tip of the spear in many respects for, and I think you could argue the same thing, arguably with the Viagra case, the use of race is the tip of the spear, I think, for this sort of neoliberal agenda. It's almost the easiest point of entry. Just talk about how that's being used.
Yeah, in a short sentence. I think the thing that's critical about that is that it's being used in the most destructive and deceptive ways. As I said in the Jacobin article, we talk about black and brown children kind of indirectly, right? Where all of these reforms are the pressure points are in high poverty black and brown school districts and schools, and we talk about the achievement gap. So we're always sort of alluding to race as an issue. We're never allowed to talk about racism. We're never allowed to talk about the fact that these corporate reforms are being driven by rich white men who, as Eddie Scheister, who's one of my favorite blog, talks about, like, we're supposed to believe that they care more about black and brown children than the teachers who go into the schools every day to work with those children and to help them have meaningful lives. So there's this really destructive exploitation of what are profound structural issues in our society, which remains racist in so many ways. But then to use race as a way to say we're going to fix our schools for these children when the so-called fixes are making schools more dehumanizing spaces for black and brown and poor children are leading to increased segregation for our schools, for black and brown children in particular, are depriving them of opportunities for the art and music and gym and joy. It's nothing short of criminal the way that race gets twisted and the way that then we're not allowed to say, what about all the white men who are making all these calls, these rich white men? So we can't talk about class and we can't talk about race in the ways that it's actually being exploited to harm people. We have to talk about it so that we can name the danger and what's being done to us, and then we have to talk about it to say, do we value our poor children? Do we value our children of color? What kind of world do we want to create for them? Why don't they have the schools that Rahm Emanuel sends his children to?
Right.
We have to really ask those questions, and it is startling to me because it seems like a really simple question to me. How come every child in this country, no matter what color their skin is, no matter where they come from when they come from home, doesn't have a school that is joyful and beautiful and well-resourced with music and art and playgrounds and lots of wonderful technology, not technology to lock them in a chair? Like, why? How come that isn't the question that our education leaders are asking us? Why doesn't Arne Duncan say, who are we as a country that we allowed there to be such inequality in our schools? That's what I want to hear from our education leaders, whether they're union leaders or they're government leaders. And I actually don't want to hear from the corporate leaders, because this is a democracy. They can get on the line with the rest of us to have what they have to say.
Barbara Maldaloni, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it, Sam. Take care.
Good luck. Bye-bye. All right, folks. Now we head into the fun half of the program. Very encouraging. Like the fact that it's happening in Massachusetts. And
a little bit of mass pride, brah.
There you go.
Take that.
Take that, Binda.
Binda.
Sure. I take it.
Don't. He take it.
Yeah, you don't.
You took it. He took it. All right. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will talk about maybe the NSA. How's that for fun?
And, not if you're a Muslim
we'll talk
civil
a little
society
bit. We're gonna,
leader.
Glenn Greenwald's going to join us sometime in the next couple of weeks, and we will talk more about that. But there's also, Louis Gelmet is talking about diseases and all of the, the nefarious plans of President Obama. We all know what's going on, don't we? The mind meld with the El Salvadoran children. Fun half, we will ask President Obama just how he managed to make El Salvador the murder capital of the world, and why.
Wasn't easy.
All right.
I'm just kidding. Thanks, Ronald Reagan. That was all you, buddy.
We're going to take a break. Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. If you can't afford a membership, by all means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I promise to get your emails fairly soon. I anticipate having more time on my hands. Also, next week, just to look ahead, we're going to be going to Netroots Nation, and by we, I mean me. Matt and Michael will be sitting here in the office, sweltering. No air conditioning on, incidentally, while I'm gone. And you can also support this program and I guess we should have had a meetup. I just saw something on Twitter where Pac-Man and TYT's having a meetup, and somehow
some more stuff like that soon.
I get left out of a lot of that stuff. I don't know what it is, but I'm just not on people's radar.
It's weird.
It's weird.
And by extension, we do.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
That's Yeah, you guys are in the...
Actually, I think you got to tell the Young Turks you're going, because I think they were interested in something with you going.
Oh, well, way to let me know about that.
Well, I didn't know you were going.
What?
Hey, I'm out of this.
All right. Hey, we gotta expand, I think.
Excuse me.
The break room.
If I may. Wait, can I may? If I may. Still a booth.
Folks, you can also support this program by going to majoritycickback.com, clicking on the Amazon link. If you buy crap from Amazon, there is no excuse for you not to go to majoritycickback.com, click on this Amazon link, bookmark it. Anytime you buy something from Amazon, simply go to that bookmarked link. You will notice no difference. We get a kickback. We notice it. It's pennies of your purchase, but if enough people do it, then we'll have a lot of pennies. And then we pool them together and we take them down to the bank and we get dollar bills for it. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. I think we get a kickback from that too. I'm not even 100% sure, but I think so. But it's also a great blend. That's the one I enjoy. They made it virtually for me. Almost totally for me. That's a win-win-win. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be part of the show. And, of course, you can IM me at Majority FM via the app, majorityapp.com. People love it. It's free. We don't even have advertising on there because I'm so lazy. I can't figure out how to do that. I'm sure there's a way. And I'll get around to it, believe me, soon enough. So enjoy it now. All right, see you in a minute.